our initial reaction was just like, I don't know any way that we can send 19 emails without people being annoyed. I mean, even though the brand's not going to be around anymore, we don't want to lose the brand love and the brand equity by just spamming people.
Yeah, that's really a challenge.
Welcome to Email Swipes, where we peek behind the scenes at the emails that catch your attention and earn their place in your swipe file. Every other week, we'll talk to an email expert about an experiment they ran, and in the following episode, we'll dive into the strategies and methods used in the email so you can inform and inspire your own email work. I'm Nikki Elvas, the copywriter behind winning emails for 8- and 9-figure SaaS and e-commerce brands like Shopify, Four Sigmatic, and Sprout Social. And I know that hearing the background stories to these emails will help you turn pie-in-the-sky insights into plug-and-play actions. Ready to make inspiration tactical? Let's go. First, let's read today's email. A farewell rant. Yep, we're still closing down. And that means it's time for the gloves to come off. Inhales deeply. We've written you hundreds, if not thousands, of emails over the last 5 years, and not one of them has properly expressed how much we truly appreciate your loyalty, business, and dare we say, friendship. Oh, we went there. You have been an outstanding, nay, incredible part of the Drizly journey, and we wouldn't trade it for all of King Midas's gold. In your face, King Midas, stick to tires. The memories we made together will echo throughout eternity and hopefully make for at least a full page in the yearbook that is your life. Too brutal? Too offensive? Well, send your complaints to driz.lee@fakeemailaccount.netbiz. Rant over. We love you. A farewell apology. Hey, Nikki. Now that we've had some time to think, we realize that our last email, a farewell rant, check your inbox, might have featured a bit too radical candor. So we're now writing for the final time to apologize and reiterate how much we truly will miss you. Seriously. This has been the most fulfilling email-based friendship we've ever had. Top 10, at least. Just think of all the memories we had. Are you thinking about them? Because we are. Remember that time you ordered drinks for that thing and everyone loved it? Classic you. Anyways, goodbye. It's been real. A farewell haiku. 2 weeks till we close. Get your orders in now, friends. Haikus are hard to end. Shop now. Cheers. Thanks for 12 years of love, support, and drinks. Mostly the drinks, but those other things too. Cheers, friends.
Jared, thank you so much for joining us. Tell everyone, please, who you are and what you do.
Yeah, happy to be here. My name is Jared Jones, currently the senior copywriter at Black & Decker on their campaigns team, Stanley Black & Decker. I'm specifically on the Craftsman wing of things. I guess I'm more known, if you could say that, in the copywriting world.
For sure.
For Drizly, where I was senior copywriter there for about 5 years.
Cool. 5 years. Nice. I actually was wondering, I don't remember how long ago, maybe it was 5 years ago, like getting an email that said, hey, I'm Jared and I'm the guy behind the emails. Was that when you first started or was that, you know, you kind of started and wormed your way in and convinced everyone that you can be a face behind the emails?
Oh, wow. You really are a follower.
Yes. I told you I was a Drizly fan.
Yeah, that's old school. I think that was about maybe a month or so in. I was at Wayfair prior to that for about a year and a half. And yeah, basically I was kind of Drizly's first copywriter. They had an email associate basically doing everything prior to me. And she had laid the groundwork for early what like the brand voice was. So their emails were already kind of held in high regard. So I was carrying the torch and that email was to be like, hey, you know, I'm all about like, I think more brands should just kind of talk about the people behind it. And I think it's just a good way to humanize the brand. So that was my attempt to, you know, do that.
Were there any responses to that? Like, did people feel like, oh, cool, there's a person here and respond and, you know, make that personal introduction themselves?
Yeah, I mean, early on, I was also kind of running our social media. I was basically writing all our copy across everything. I was doing our B2B newsletters. I was doing any out-of-home stuff we got. I was writing some earlier ads that we had. And yeah, definitely got some replies on Twitter about that. I got some in memoriams for our previous copywriter who left a really great email, our email associate. And I mean, we did a couple emails throughout the years. Like I'm kind of contradictory to the whole humanizing the brand thing. Like I was in a couple social videos and stuff, but I am not really I don't want to be the center of attention. You know, I was not like wanting to place myself in the center, but as we were developing this voice and we saw it was getting a bit of play just on social and things like that, we were like, okay, let's just kind of lean into it a little bit. And for a couple years there, I was signing off all the emails with, you know, various, you know, sign-offs, I guess you'd call them, just like Drizly's anonymous writer guy, Drizly's email whatever, and just kind of doing that for quite a while.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a very delicate balance of having faces behind your brand and also making it be about the brand, making it be about the customer. And then also there's the whole debate about showcasing the people, and then the people leave and take their whole audience with them. And right. So it's always, there's a lot of tricky bits there. So, okay. So you mentioned that the associate left like with a bang, and she had started developing the voice. So what was that voice development? What was it like? You know, how did you come in, and how much further did you develop it? What was that development process like?
When I first came in, our marketing team at that time was around 3 or 5 people. It was a really small team, really scrappy team. And, you know, we were sending way fewer emails at the time, again, just because of capacity. But we had basically a Google Doc of push notes and some subject lines. And I could just get the vibe from that, you know, we were kind of leaning into, which my specialty, I come from a comedy background. So it was kind of this absurdist voice. There was a lot of, you know, one of the pushes I remember that they had sent was like a horror story. And it was like, you're the person at the party ran out of beer, in the distance sirens, you know, like the party descends into chaos. And I just saw from that and a couple of the subject lines, I was like, okay, there's something here. I mean, what originally drew me to Drizzly, I had just, you know, left my previous role and I was considering getting back into freelance. I was in journalism and/slash blogging for years. I was a film critic for a little while. I covered the UFC and mixed martial arts for years. And I was looking to potentially get back into that because I just enjoyed the kind of freedom and the time freedom. But then I saw the job posting for Drizzly probably the day or two after I had left the previous role. And it had that kind of voice to it too. And I was like, okay, there's something here with this brand. I'll apply and see what happens. And then within a couple of weeks, I had the role, which was great because at that point I was mostly untested copywriter. I had only been in the, you know, copywriting about probably under 2 years. Mm-hmm. So then it was just, you know, a lot of trial and experimentation as we developed and we brought on other copywriters and I was managing some of them. My thought was always test the fences. Like, I'd rather you send me something that's too weird and we can't send it than something that's too bland. So that's kind of where I leaned in immediately and was like, okay, let's go as weird as possible and just see what is accepted, what isn't, where those kind of fences are. And that's where we build our earlier brand books and all of that around to develop the voice.
Very cool. So did you hit any fences that you crossed too far that you saw? Okay, wait, this was too far. We have to pull back.
Yeah, a lot. I mean, for me, it wasn't necessarily that I saw the fences. There were definitely times, I mean, we tried some early like kind of sale where it was all handheld shot in the office on our phones. And it was like, oh, the Drizzly extravaganza bonanza deal. And it just like, it was maybe a little too absurdist where I don't think we had quite developed the following that was aware of our voice as much at that point.
Right. They took you seriously.
Yeah, exactly.
They're like, these guys are just weird.
I don't know how they ever did. But it was tough because I wasn't in the position necessarily where the blowback was going to come directly to me. So I was always
nice.
Yeah. Which is an easy position to be in, you know, it's a, oh, well, we should just try this. Let's just try this. Let's get weirder with it. And most of the fences were determined by people we brought on or other teams where they were like, what are we doing? What is this email? I mean, this is basically a meme. Like, this doesn't have any marketing at all in it. And I was like, yeah, I know, it's branding. and that little difference only takes you so far. After a while, you have to be like, okay, I guess we actually have to drive action from people and we have to do things that, you know, make sense as a marketer. But that's kind of where the fence is. And then the fences kind of over the years as we got bigger, you know, they kind of started to narrow a bit just in terms of we wanted to, you know, understandably drive, again, more action, convert people a lot faster, test more, which, you know, I'm always of the mindset of say the weird thing, do the weird thing. Like a lot of brands now are, I think, unfortunately, try to appeal to everyone and then end up not appealing to anyone as a result. You know, it's trying to be a part of every audience. But as we got bigger and we tried to, you know, if there is something that you can test, and if it turns out that the bland thing is better than the brand thing, then that's what you got to do, which wasn't always the case with us. But that's just where we found those fences over the years, is testing subject lines, even though, you know, a lot of our weirdest subject lines, some, we had one for Halloween one year that was just the whole time, and it got a lot of social play, it got a lot of clicks. So it wasn't always strict fences, but that's kind of how we found them a lot of the time.
Well, that was one thing that I found cool was that as Drizly grew, it kept its voice. Whereas many times you'll see brands start to, like you said, narrow, but they still kept it, which was cool. And also there was like a nice balance where the website was, the UX was first. You know, there were little things in different places, but the whole shopping experience was very standard, basic. You know, it was within the emails and the social media and the all that kind of thing, which is where more of the relationship is happening. And the site is like the conversion site, so that, you know, it was a good balance. It was very well done.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, throughout our years, as we kind of brought more people on, there was definitely a lot of internal debate. There was a lot of our brand team really pushing to try and get things out there that necessarily other teams might not have wanted. And so it was tough. It was definitely a fight to maintain that brand over the years and push it. Because for me, we were a very email heavy brand. And I was trying to, over the years, transfer that to our social media and try to bring more of that voice to other channels. I, for years, wanted to just completely overhaul our whole site, like every product page. There's a great brand, I believe they're UK-based, called Firebox, and they have the greatest product PDP description pages for everything they have, and that are all just little jokes here and there. And I wanted to do that for years. Just kind of, you know, it was one of those big projects that we just never could get around to. But because we were operating so heavily in email, that was where we fought hardest for the brand, just because that was everything we had. Not everything we had. We had a great social team and we had other areas, but we weren't able to like make the changes that we wanted on the product side as much. And social was, you know, a whole other team with their own view of where the brand should go. And we collaborated with them a lot. But yeah, the email was, it was a push and pull for sure.
Yeah, because risks are risks. Yeah. People are always uncomfortable and you really got to keep justifying it.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this particular set of emails. When you found out, okay, Drizly's gone, they're gone. What were your thoughts there in terms of, okay, we're planning the goodbye, now what?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's fortunately or unfortunately, the same day that we found out we were shutting down in X months, we found out about this campaign. It was already in plan. So we found out that same day, hey, we have this campaign and, you know, for legal reasons, I can't really get into, we found out that basically we had to send out around 19 emails.
Wow.
I think 20 or so pushes. Some were to signal like the days of different services were ending. Like we have shipping in addition to just the on-demand delivery. So we had to stagger it for a while. And our initial reaction was just like, I don't know any way that we can send 19 emails without people being annoyed. I mean, even though the brand's not going to be around anymore, we don't want to lose the brand love and the brand equity by just spamming people.
Yeah, that's really a challenge. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the idea was kind of born out of that.
We're about to take an ad break, but I'm not just going to give you an ad that wants to sell you something. I'm going to give you an ad that, yes, will hopefully sell you something, but will also educate you on something email related. So don't go anywhere. If you want to start your own email list, I have an offer for you. Sign up to ConvertKit using the affiliate link you'll find in the show notes, and I'll give you a 30-minute consult free. Now, free consults are nice and all, but they're not exactly a reason to tie yourself to an email platform you're not in love with. So let me tell you why I think you should use ConvertKit to build your email list. ConvertKit calls themselves the only marketing platform built for creators by creators, and it's not just a cute slogan. They actually live up to this. There are countless examples of how they serve our particular niche better than anyone else, and it makes all the difference. Let me just give you one. Google just announced some new anti-spam sending requirements that threw the email world into a tizzy. And one of the recommendations to keep our emails out of spam was to verify your email sending domain. Sounds techie? Yeah, it was. It was another techie admin task that was really annoying to deal with. Most email platforms slapped up some help docs and called it a day. ConvertKit partnered with a software that did the job in the ConvertKit dashboard in a few clicks. It was so helpful and it was so proactive. They know we don't have IT teams. They know we have too many tasks on our plate. They know that tech can feel really overwhelming for a solopreneur. So they figured out a solution. That's just one tiny example. I could go on, but we've got to get back to our show. Meanwhile, if you're interested, head down to the show notes, check out the affiliate link, and earn yourself a free consult.
I mean, we had two ideas. The one we ended up going with, part of the inspiration was just the language we were using in our briefs was the sunsetting of Drizly. Mm. So I kind of, this is going to way date me because it's even way before me, but there's this movie, there's this Western movie called Shane that was out in the 50s. It was considered the last Western. And at the end of the movie is a guy literally riding off into the sunset,
it's
right?
The classic,
yeah. Yeah, so, and that's why everything And it was kind of signaling like the end of the Western's prominence in America. I was a film student, can you tell? So that image kind of became the template for the imagery we used in the campaign. Mm, and then just knowing that we had 19 goodbyes to send, I was like, how this is going to be, and this was kind of my pitch, was like, this is going to be annoying to people. Let's lean into that. There's this movie called They Came Together. It's kind of like a satirical romantic comedy. It's got Paul Rudd, Amy Schumer, and there's a scene in it where Paul Rudd and I think his brother in the movie, it's Schmidt from New Girl. Like, I forget the actor's name, but they're basically in a room and like one of them's giving them advice and they're just continuously walking away from each other and they keep turning back and going, hey, thanks. And like, hey, brother, thanks. And they just keep saying it over and over again until it goes through that cycle of like, it's not funny. It's funny again, you know? And I was like, let's just do that, but as an email. So that was the primary pitch. I mean, my second pitch was, let's just send the same email 20 times in a row.
Oh, gosh.
And they were like, yeah, because basically my thought was, you know, we have this time period that we all have to be primarily, we should be looking for new jobs. This email series might not be the biggest thing in our, you know, we have bigger life issues. So my other pitch was, let's just do the same one 20 times. And that kind of shot down. So we're just like, okay, let's do one where, you know, for me, it's writing an email. You know, I can write up some silly copy, like some of the ones we've done. I mean, the haiku one, for example, that was like 15 minutes of work. Our designers still have to do a couple hours worth of work coming up with all this stuff. So that's where we came up with the idea of like, let's do this sunset, the Shane sunset, but with the bear just kind of getting closer. So they didn't have to do as much work and it wasn't as daunting a task for them. And that's kind of where it ended up going.
I love how you took the idea of like riding off into the sunset and put it for the imagery also, not just the feeling and the vibe for the copy. It's great.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a screenwriter for fun, kind of outside of when I'm working. So I do think visually. I went to school, again, for filmmaking and music production. And I've always been a kind of visual thinker, even when I write music and I think of the visuals that go along with it. So it's always been a part of how I write. And this one was just one where I'm like, I think it's a fitting, not metaphor, but I think it fits it. And it's not a ton of work for our designers to just, you know, because we got to get out there and start finding new jobs, essentially.
Yeah, you're taking care of your team. That's awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great. But I love also what you said in terms of the, it's funny, it's not funny. It's funny, it's not funny, because that's exactly how people experience these kinds of things, where when you lean into something that's so obvious, it's so funny, but then it's like, oh, but it's obvious. I can't find this funny anymore. And then it is funny again. So yeah. That's really, yeah, perceptive. That's cool. That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm an unabashed Family Guy fan. I think, you know, they might miss like 5 out of every 10 jokes, but some of them, like, I think it's underrated how they have probably changed how we deal with comedy and a lot of their jokes, whether it's like flashback style humor, which you see in everything now, or that kind of joke where it's just one long through the boring part, back to funny again. I love that kind of running bit. And, you know, whenever we can kind of infuse that kind of humor and that personality into what I do, I lean into it as hard as I can.
It's really true. There are so many things that people love to make fun of. Like, it's not funny, you know, but everyone loves it. So clearly there's something there that, you know, you don't want to admit it because like it's too cool to say that you like it, but but you do.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, half my brainstorming strategy, if you could call it that, is like, I'm never afraid to look like the dumbest person in the room by throwing something out there. And I think, you know, especially in the age of Zoom and everything where it's even more awkward maybe than going in. I mean, I'm, you know, I love working remotely, but I think maybe one of the areas where it has a little, you know, comes up short is that kind of brainstorming, because it makes it even more awkward for people to kind of throw an idea out there and just leave it hanging in open space. And that's never been a concern of mine. If people think I'm the dumbest person in the room for the idea I pitch, so be it.
It's really true, especially if it's like, wait, you're on mute. What did you just say? And it's like, forget it. Like, exactly. I'll just keep my idea in my head. Yes, for sure. I thought you were going to say your strategy for ideas was watching Family Guy. Like, that's your method.
It's definitely, I mean,
this is working time, boss.
Can I get paid to do this? That'd be amazing. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's definitely inspired a thing or two out throughout the years, but I don't know if it's defined. I don't really have a definable creative process, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to define a creative process. There are definitely steps and things that you can do, but to really lay it out, like, part of it is that lightning bolt, but there is also all the steps you have to lay out before, but they can vary. And it also depends so much on the context and what the project is and who you're working with. And there's just, it's a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had a, you know, our brand/creative team, it kind of shifted names throughout the year at Drizly. I had a great team of people. Mm-hmm. Sarah Holcomb, she was our head of copy in particular, is just an amazing creative and an amazing leader. She was someone who would go to bat for our team when we had these out there ideas. And then also Tony Jorgensen is a guy who worked, he was the copywriter who kind of I brought into the team. He was also just like, he was a comedy first background writer. He didn't really, if I remember correctly, he kind of didn't have a huge copywriting background before we started, before we hired him on. And I kind of rallied for him just saying, you know, I think copywriting skills can be taught to a degree. Like comedy skills are really hard to teach to someone. It's really hard to teach a sense of humor and to teach a frame of reference for all of these things. And it was great to have those kind of creatives to work alongside with. And also, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't shout out Kirk Anderson, who is a guy we brought in. He was our kind of head of social, and he is just, he worked for Taco Bell. He's worked for a lot of these great brands, and he just kind of helped us sit in that room and have that awkward airtime where we just threw ideas at the wall. And it just, you know, it made us all kind of have to step up our game and be like, okay, these are what are feasible. Because a lot of the time when you're pitching ideas, you have no idea of like, I mean, we'd sometimes get an idea of the budget. We'd sometimes not, you know, you just, oh, let's rent a giant truck and turn it into a pool and throw a Drizly pool party that's deliverable. Nice. That was an idea we had like back in the day. And it was just, but how any of this, you know, you need those production people that know the real, like the plausibility of being able to do any of these things. And that's another, I guess, fence, but that's at least a fence where you can kind of begin to operate within in terms of the creative process. So definitely it helps to have good people around you for sure.
Oh, for sure. For sure. It reminds me when I was in college and I went for advertising, and we always had these crazy ideas. Like, you know, the teacher would give us a brief and we would just come up with these nutty ideas. And I was always like, so this isn't possible. We wouldn't have the budget for this. This wouldn't be possible in the time frame. This wouldn't be possible because X, Y, Z. And the response was always like, okay, go for the crazy and then pare it down. We didn't actually pare it down in school, but eventually they told us, you know, once you get to an agency, like go for the crazy and then you'll pare it down in agency work. And like, that's how you get the great ideas, is you just have to go all the way.
Yeah. Yep. You always want to have like roughly, you know, three ideas, I'd say. You have your really conservative one, you have your kind of middle of the road, and then you have your extreme one. And then it's kind of the order in which you pitch those things. I think sometimes that can lead to one. You go from your least crazy to your craziest to then your middle of the road. So then it doesn't feel like the craziest one is maybe that crazy because you've had the idea after that to like, okay, like sometimes you do some tricks of just, you know, maybe pitch the middle of the road one a little less, you know, with a little less vigor, something like that. You want to capture that, like, you know, it's mind games, I guess, in a fun way.
That's great. I never thought about that. You know, there's always like price anchoring and all that kind of thing. But when you're trying to get ideas, that's great. That's a smart idea. Cool. Okay. So what were you expecting the feedback and results to be for these emails? I mean, actually, there were conversion results. You were trying to get people to get their last orders in. So that's interesting. Okay. It wasn't just branding.
I mean, at the time of writing them, I wasn't super concerned with conversion necessarily, just knowing how many we had to write. We had a kind of, not a fail safe, but basically the notion was like, if these emails aren't converting after the first few, we're going to pull the plug because we don't want to send 30, you know, emails if we don't necessarily have to. So for me, I was basically like, the happiest reactions I got on social were people basically, you know, saying, we need to check on the Drizly guy. Is he okay? Like, that's kind of the reaction I was hoping for. I want people to just generally be concerned for my well-being while reading my stuff. But luckily, the, you know, whether it was just the nostalgia or, you know, I don't know if it can necessarily be. I think a big part of it obviously is the way that we went about saying we're going out of business. You know, we kind of had the same kind of, you know, irreverent style to it. It did, if I recall correctly, have like pretty great conversions for a lot of the email. It did up, you know, we saw a spike in orders for the majority of them, I think. But yeah, it wasn't the top of mind when writing them.
Right.
I was just like, I don't know. Well, let's just go out with a bang. Let's have some fun. And, you know, people were sharing all these reactions with me. And there was even some on LinkedIn who were like, should I be offended by this email? Like, if I was working at this company and I saw this cavalier of an email about going out of business, I'd be upset. And I was It's like, yeah, but I mean, I was also the one who was going to be out of a job.
Right,
so
exactly.
I'm part of the affected class here. So, yeah, there's reactions all across the board. Most of them seem positive. But yes, I was just hoping that, you know, if we got sold some extra product, that's great. But as long as people kind of felt it was a fitting kind of end to the brand, I was happy with that.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting also because when you have an irreverent kind of voice, you will always get those kinds of reactions where they're like kind of offended, but kind of not because they know you're being irreverent, but they're not sure. So
yeah,
it fits into the whole vibe. So it works.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There were definitely like when COVID first started, for instance, you know, it was kind of tough to, that was like a real testing point. And that was early into my career at Drizly of how do we navigate this very serious thing, sending out very serious emails about, you know, this store might be closed, here's how to get orders in, and how do we still do that while still being the jester of sorts, you know? That was definitely like a test. But other than that, I don't think many people are opening up emails from an alcohol delivery company expecting like a kind of serious take on world news or anything like that. You know, as long as you're not like offending any, you know, religious or protected class or anything like that, I don't see how someone could possibly really be offended by anything. But then again, we did have an email once that it was basically like someone was offended because it was from we were talking about right-handers versus left-handers, and they were a left-hander, and they wrote an email to us saying how offended they were by it. So you can find whole new ways to offend people that you didn't know exist, which, I mean, you know, I'm not one of these, oh, cancel culture, cancel, you know, especially when you're writing for a brand where you're trying to make money. But it is, you know, you just have to, again, that's just another fun way of finding the fences, you know?
Yeah, it's true. That's a good point.
No left-handed jokes. Don't do those anymore.
Those are too much.
That was a simple one. I was like, okay, I think that's not going to affect us too much. If you're good at comedy and you're good at this, you can find ways around any fence that's put in.
You'll find other jokes besides the left-handed jokes.
Yeah. Yeah. Can we do a left foot? Is that okay?
Oh, that's great. Was it emotional hitting send in any way, or was it just like, we have these 19 emails, we got to get out, we're just hitting send?
It wasn't until like kind of maybe a few days after all of it was said and done. You know, we kind of plan these things so far in advance that you're not really living in the moment and writing them in the moment. I mean, when I first started there, you know, before we had project managers and things like that, we were writing, this email was written and it was sending in an hour. You know, you had to get this done. And luckily, we got to a place where we were, you know, a couple months ahead of schedule, roughly. And so it wasn't really like that emotional until afterward, because, you know, this was a brand that I put a lot of myself into. And it was, you know, my first kind of bigger copywriting undertaking. I'd never really had an ability to control or define a brand's voice to that degree. Mm-hmm. So it definitely, by the end, knowing it was over, you know, obviously there's the feelings of, you know, there's wrapped up in failure. You're like, oh, I guess people didn't really like this brand that much. Oh. Was that the issue? And you know, it wasn't the do or die factor at the end of the day. But, it, you know, wrapped in with all of that was just seeing the outpouring of appreciation and love from all these people of this thing that, you know, I'm just sitting behind a computer at the end of the day writing this stuff. And this is something, you know, when I was a blogger journalist, it kind of was a similar thing where you don't see the millions of people that are reading this thing and on a daily basis. There's just you and you're kind of in your corner of the world, and seeing that people from all over the country are reading emails, which, you know, you get the numbers back on how many people are reading each one sometimes, but you're never really like thinking about how, you know, marketing might impact someone's life to that degree. I'm always just trying to, if I can make someone smile, that's like my job. If I can make someone laugh, I'm satisfied. But you never, mm-hmm. seeing all these people be like, oh, I'm going to miss these emails. I'm like, wow, mm-hmm. I've always said that like us in the marketing departments tend to over index, I think, like, oh, we don't want this email to sound too much like this one we sent. And I'm like, guys, no one is following these like chapters of a book. We're going to be okay if there's similar language in here. But then you hear these things and you're like, oh, I guess some people are.
People are actually reading them.
Yeah, they're reading every one. I mean, you knew the ones from 5 years ago.
I can't say I remember them all, but.
No, I can't say I do either.
That's true. After you sent so many also.
Yeah.
Know? Okay. If you were to go back in time and perfect these emails, would you do anything differently?
You know, we had like in our original pitch, which was a little bit more thorough than we ended up going with, because again, we were trying to save our designers and everyone else some time and not have to put time that they could spend finding a new job and bigger life issues. But originally our pitch included like, oh, let's do one where, You know, we are gathering like fake made fan art from the years and like fake love. And then we could do one of like fake hate that people are real hate that people have sent us over the years. So it's like we could go through every step. And that was one thing we pitched originally. And then it just was not feasible, the amount of time that we would need to either design or gather all this info. So that would probably be the one thing I would change about it. But other than that, I think it felt great. Like it wrapped up in a way that I think did the brand justice.
Okay, so now that you have this new role, you kind of have to prove yourself. What are you planning? Do you have any creative freedom? What are things now like for you?
I'm very early into this role, so I'm still in that onboarding stage. I haven't really gotten a lot of detail necessarily on the kind of bigger projects that I'll be working on. So I'm very limited right now in just terms of what I know about the brand. But that said, you know, I joined and they immediately were like, based on your portfolio, we think you'd work with this Craftsman brand better. They kind of have this campaign going now with kind of 80s rock, 80s metal dad kind of thing, which is a little more of their comedic. It's a more comedic brand. And luckily I have this music background too. So it's definitely, you know, these brands, it's a tough transition going from a brand that is willing to try a lot to a brand that has, you know, been around for 100 years. A lot of these Stanley Black & Decker brands have been around 100+ years, and you know, they have their ways that they're set in. But part of the thing that drew me to this role was their marketing department is kind of undergoing the shift of bringing more things in internal brand studio. And they kind of want to push that kind of brand led marketing now. So it's kind of, in a way, it feels like I'm back in the beginning of the early Drizzly days of like, okay, let's try to, I think the fences might be a little tighter, but we can still kind of test them a bit because we are kind of undertaking this new venture. But I'm hoping that if I can do something that's, you know, 30% as weird as what I was able to do with Drizzly, I think that would be a start. It's definitely more conservative of a brand, but that's the hope, is to get to a place where we can do some really weird by their standards stuff.
Very cool. Okay, so last question. What is your favorite brand? Now that we don't have Drizzly to swipe emails from, what's your favorite brand to get emails from and why?
I mean, the obvious one, which I'm sure everyone says, I am a huge Liquid Death fan. I mean, not just because I'm a metalhead, but like I love their stuff. I love how it touches everything they do. Like it's on their email, it's on their can, it's in their experiences, it's on their product page. You know, it is, everything is so, and it's a good example again of like, this is a brand who's not trying to be something for everybody. We know what we are. And we know the audience we're going after. I mean, obviously they're expanding over time and trying to fit new audiences, but it's really like people want that. I don't know if it was a TikTok or something that was like, say the weird thing. People want realness. That Liquid Death is like the encapsulation of that. I think they know what they're about. And I just love their brand. Email specifically though, another good one is they're a sunglasses company called Gooder. They're very much like, they do a lot of fun partnerships. I think they just did one with like Street Fighter that just came out, and again, really know what they're doing in terms of really like, they know what their brand is, they know what they're about. Their emails are very Drizzly coded, or maybe were Gooder coded. I don't know. I didn't know about them until deep into my Drizzly tenure, but they write with this kind of absurdist, irreverent voice. Chubbies is another one. I really like Chubbies stuff. Yeah. They're not a brand I would probably like buy stuff from necessarily, though it's a, you know, it's a men's shorts company. They're not really my style, but like their social presence and their emails are just, they're great. Chubbies is a little more broier, I guess you'd say, which again, it knows its audience. But yeah, those are a few of the great ones, I think.
There's something I feel like too, observing other people's niches, like where you see like, okay, they're talking to those people and I'm not one of those people, but I'm going to watch how they do it. Like that can be very good inspiration to apply to, you know, whatever niche you are serving.
Yeah, I mean, a while back at Drizzly, I covered the UFC for a while. I like to watch wrestling occasionally. And to me, it's like, as opposed to being one of this brand that is trying to be all things for all people, I like to find little niche audiences and attack those within. And, you know, that's where you can kind of build out brand loyalty from. Years ago for Drizzly, I did a subject line that was just, it's Friday, you know what that means. And it was a reference to a guy, Brody Lee, his name was. He was a professional wrestler. And basically his whole online persona was just, it's blank day, you know what that means, was every tweet he ever sent. That's the whole thing. Wow. And unfortunately, he had just passed away unexpectedly, probably like a week before, maybe it was that week. And so I kind of did this email as a tribute to him. And it got up to the point online where like guys from, I think he's in AEW, which is a wrestling organization. They were like responding to the tweet, like the people's tweets about like, look at Drizzly. Is this a Brody Lee reference? And, me running the Twitter at the time was like, you know, it was like,
that's great.
Yeah. So it's just like finding those things. I mean, you can earn someone's loyalty forever with stuff like that. And again, it's just like finding that those niche audiences and just not exploiting them, but like, you know, leaning into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talking to them, finding that relevance, finding that connection. Yeah,
exactly.
Cool. All right. This has been very enlightening. Lots of like little pieces that I can't wait to like dig into. So thank you so much. This was awesome.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. This was great. I never thought my first podcast would be about emails, but this is this is a great conversation.
You'll have to get one for music and for wrestling and for all your other interests too.
Yes. Yeah, I guess so.
Thanks for joining me for Email Story Time. If you enjoyed today's story, give this podcast a review so email marketers like you can have more fun with email. See you next week when we dig into this story's takeaways.